I am Charlie Bennett, and this is the North Avenue Lounge. Welcome to the North Avenue Lounge on WREK Atlanta. I am Charlie Bennett, and I'm trying to make this microphone work the way it should, and it is not. In the studio with me today is Tyson Duffy, a writer, editor, literary critic, and playwright here in Atlanta. And full disclosure, friend of mine for going on 15 years now or
Must
something
be,
like that.
Must be, yeah.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit more about those 15 years so I can do a sound check on you.
The 15 years of our friendship?
Or anything. I just need you to talk now.
We met a long time ago, Charlie.
both in time and in mental stance.
Yeah, time and a place that just seems so distant. Different circles of friends that are long lost.
All right.
Tyson, yeah, we stuck it out.
Yeah, Tyson is here because of our friendship. We have had multiple political discussions over the past couple years that have had an edge of humor to them because, you know, like just trash talk around particular sports or games. Mm-hmm. But also it began to develop into a much more intellectualized or even soul-searching kind of discussion, especially as we've been building up to this most recent, not recent, this upcoming primary season or in... It's so hard for me to think of what it is, actually, because it seems to jump from state to state until it affects us in 2 weeks, 1 week.
Right, right. You mean on the Super Tuesday, the primaries?
Yeah, we're not Super Tuesday, though, right? Aren't we?
No, that's March 3rd. We're not, yeah, we're
yeah,
not
we get
Super
our
Tuesday.
Own thing, yeah. Our so thing it's almost like later. We're not, it's
July,
not happening
actually.
To us, yeah.
No.
But it became clear that you and I could have a useful conversation on the North Avenue Lounge if we talked about this kind of the development or redevelopment of our own understandings of our political stance in terms of a kind of left-leaning American tradition.
Sure.
So I should preface it with two things. One, WREK Atlanta does not support, oppose, or in any way benefit any candidate or political party. And all the opinions and beliefs that Tyson and I are about to espouse are ours alone. And two, Tyson, I don't think you knew this until right now. This is my last host guest North Avenue Lounge show.
Oh, no.
Yeah, we're finishing the run of the show. There'll be some reruns and some best ofs and a full like host review. But you're my last guest for one of my shows.
I gotta say, I'm honored.
Yeah.
And saddened by this news.
I'm delighted to have a friend sort of ease it out for me.
Great. It was a great show. I listened to a bunch of episodes before I came on. It was really sharp stuff.
Thank you. You're not allowed to hype. Okay. So let's give folks the, if not the the terms of battle, then at least sort of the landscape that you and I are discussing this in.
Okay.
You and I are both on the left side of the dial and of politics generally. Does that sound right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
And so everything we talk about now is coming out of the debate within the Democratic primary and within the populace itself about the tenets of the left-leaning American political scene.
Okay.
Yeah. So you go ahead and you diagnose me. As you did in one of our recent discussions. Of like, what do you think I am, Tyson?
What do I think you are? Oh, Charlie.
Yeah, right.
You're a good poker player.
I appreciate the thought.
I would say, you know, I'm not gonna dig into you precisely, but I think there is... You are probably attached to a sort of liberal tradition in politics that I think has to ask itself some questions these days in terms of the future, you know, for the 21st century, for American politics and American democracy. The liberal tradition is attached to not just Obama and Clinton, but goes all the way back to FDR, Roosevelt, the administrative state, and the liberal establishment itself. And attached to things like media and academia.
Is there any part of what I do that, like my behavior, that makes you think I am in that tradition? Or is it in the particular candidates I have professed a preference for, or my general, you know, stance on who's president?
Well, not in you specifically. I think it comes out here and there in terms of, you know, the way we discuss things. But, you know, just speaking more broadly, you know, the liberal establishment is institutional. It's churches, it's academia, it's schools, it's media. It's also, you know, the State Department and the direction of our democracy and our foreign policy. And I think liberals would be more likely to identify with that set of institutions than would people more to the left, your progressives and people who call themselves socialists and things like that.
Okay. And how would you define yourself?
I would definitely define myself as a progressive. That is, somebody who sees the need for dramatic reform in the system as it stands now.
And do you think that you would always be a progressive? Do you think you always would lean towards some kind of dramatic change? Or do you feel like your progressivism is temporary or temporal at this moment?
I would say my views go from issue to issue. So if we see an entrenched system of power, whether that's in academia or the military or somewhere else or the media, you stand up to it and you question it and you dissemble it if it's not functioning democratically or appropriately.
That's your personal belief.
That's my personal belief. And if you see a system of that is a system as we have now, a sort of late capitalist system where the production of poverty has sort of gone off the edge. Healthcare has been in crisis for decades. Something like 65,000 people a year die because of the privatized insurance system. You have all kinds of the deaths of despair have been on the rise for 10 or 20 years. We've seen some real crises one after another. And it seems to me that if there were ever a time for dramatic reforms in our system, democratically speaking, I'm not talking about imposing some kind of ideology. I'm talking about reforming for the purposes of improving quality of life for people.
Yeah.
In America.
And we talked a little bit about your sort of political history before we got on air.
We did.
And you said that this has not always been exactly how you framed your sense of what has to happen politically.
Yeah. You know, when I was younger, I was a libertarian socialist, which is another term for somebody who likes to look cool in front of girls. No, I'm just kidding.
that might actually be true, kind of. Yeah.
You know, anarchism, that kind of thing. You know, everybody has their political sort of flowering period where they're reading this or that. I read a lot of Chomsky and Tariq Ali and Charles Johnson and Arundhati Roy and learned a lot about global politics. I went to India. I was a part of this sort. There's a issue, lots of issues in India, but there was a sort of a water protectors, much like we have here at Standing Rock, going on in India. And I went over there and learned a lot about, you know, socialism and activism and how private entities take over government and take land and resources and things like that. It was a very sort of informative period in my life. So that informs my views. Not a lot of my opinions and views have changed, but I'd say I call myself a progressive because I don't have the ability to be that kind of activist anymore. You know, I'm not motivated to engage in that kind of protest.
You're not
going to
handcuff yourself to a piece of machinery?
I'm not going to handcuff myself to anything. I'm not much of a joiner, sort of never was. I'm a writer. I like to be alone in a room with a pile of books. And that's just where I am in my life. But yeah, as a younger man, there was a lot more, a lot more involvement and sort of a stake in those sentiments.
Yeah. And can you picture yourself going even farther along that sort of change and finding yourself at a more conservative place as you get older?
I could never. No, I think that whole, don't you think that whole idea is kind of a myth? Do you think you're really going to wake up a Republican one day?
No, I do think
kids
it's
are
a
in
myth.
College.
No, I think it's a myth that somehow your youth is a defining portion of your politics, and then your age is a defining portion of your politics, or old age. I think that's a myth, but I do believe that our stance politically changes a lot more than our values change, in the sense that as the world changes around us, or our instant needs change.
Mm-hmm.
Like if you buy a house and have children, you know, you might then say, one might say, I might say, Tyson,
okay,
that I won't be going down to throw Molotov cocktails.
Right.
You know,
of course. Yeah.
At the WTO.
No, you have.
Meeting.
And I never did anything like that.
I know. And I'm not
nonviolent,
I'm not accusing
completely.
You. But I'm saying, like, even if I had that desire when I was a kid, even if I believe, like you were saying, you know, something that would make you seem cool in front of whoever you wanted to date, I had a very sort of anti-establishmentarianist sense of okay. everything. Smash the church, smash the government, smash whatever. That was, and I think smash whatever probably was a good mm-hmm. way to understand what I was thinking at the time. And now that I have some stake in whatever,
sure. yeah,
okay. I'm less inclined to smash. And that's what I mean by, do you find yourself, do you think you could change along that arc? Of
you're seeing you have precisely the material interests of the liberal class.
Yes.
And that is totally understandable and acceptable. Some people on the left would call it, you have to win over the normies. They might say. I wouldn't put it that way. But you can't be, in my view, you can't be throwing around ideologies and concepts that scare the liberal class, because in the end, the people who live in the neighborhoods and have kids in schools are going to have to be on your side in order for it to be effective.
Right.
So that's sort of, that makes perfect sense to
yeah.
me.
We're going to have to unpack the word liberal.
Sure.
In the sense of the history of liberalism mm-hmm. and an understanding of like the role of government and the individual in a society. Because I think, and this is the last thing we're going to say before we go to a promo so we can get ready, I think that your identification of the liberal class could include people who vote Republican on a regular
sure.
basis,
yeah.
right?
The liberal establishment as well.
Yeah.
The Republican Party is really part of the liberal establishment.
Some people's heads are exploding, I think, right now. This is the North Avenue Lounge. I'm hosting Tyson Duffy, a writer, editor, and playwright here in Atlanta for a discussion of values and politics. WREK does not endorse anything that we are saying right now. We'll be back after this. The original Research Library Rock and Roll Radio Show, broadcasting every Friday at noon right here on WREK Atlanta.
Each week, we pick a topic related to libraries or archives and free associate an hour of music, interviews, library talk, and more.
You'll hear all kinds of music, but mostly rock, in between interviews with musicians, librarians, archivists, and information scientists.
That's Lost in the Stacks, every Friday at noon, right here on WREK Atlanta. 91.1 FM.
This is the North Avenue Lounge on WREK Atlanta. My guest today is Tyson Duffy, a Atlanta writer, editor, literary critic, and playwright. We're having a conversation about political beliefs and left-leaning values. WREK does not endorse or have an opinion about what we are saying at this moment. So, Tyson, I left off the last segment basically teasing this discussion.
Mm-hmm.
What, when we say liberalism, are we talking about in this moment?
Well, in this moment, I would say we're talking about a crisis. Liberalism, extends initially out of the Enlightenment and passes through the French Revolution, all these things you can learn in a history class in college. In the American context, it becomes associated with entrenched power, the State Department, political movements, political parties, and the administrative state as constructed under FDR and public policies that promoted the well-being of a flourishing middle class for what's literally called the golden age of capitalism from the 40s to the 70s. established a kind of quality of life and a level of expectation. After the 70s, actually, not just now, but after the 70s, you started to see a right response to that kind of liberal establishment, a far-right response, not just your typical sort of conservative, but a far, far-right response to deconstruct those public policies that made people's lives better.
Now, I always see that as a framed as an anti-tax and anti-regulation movement.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Yes. Deregulation, the onslaught of neoliberalism, which is centered around deregulation, free trade. These are sort of euphemisms for really directing public wealth into what I would say, private hands. So there's this attempt around the edges, and it gets stronger and stronger. Reagan hits, Bush, Clinton actually a part of the same thing, a very conservative Democrat. Obama, who I voted for, also called himself a Republican at one point. He said he was like a 90s Republican. And this all makes sense in the context of the last 40 years, because we've seen the attempt to reformulate the establishment into something new that's based around neoliberalism, deregulation and all these things. So the liberal establishment, the liberal class has really been in crisis, which is why you see people so tense. They're on Twitter, they're screaming, they're tearing their hair out. There's a lot of anxiety. I think people feel that, not just because of major issues like global warming or the media, but because they feel that things are changing very rapidly and that there's just crisis after crisis. To me, the liberalism and the liberal class identify with the establishment, for better or worse. The establishment isn't always a bad thing, and also identify with a sense of impending sort of doom and crisis after crisis. And so the question now for liberalism is, what next? What comes next?
Yeah. And now, while I don't agree with the sort of colonial or empire-building attitude of the neoliberals, especially the project for the new American century, I find myself, as I dig, that I discover in my beliefs a much more classically liberal person than I ever expected. I have joked more than a few times, like, oh my, I'm a Republican. I didn't know it.
Yes, tell me what that means. Classically liberal, Charlie.
So
what is that?
I am recognizing more and more my belief that the liberal project, the attempt at creating a government that protects the primacy of the individual, mm-hmm. that destabilizes in a non-damaging way institutions and institutions' power over individual behavior, and a sort of reliance on the free market to construct culture and luxury, that I believe that its problem is mostly an absence of the cost of externalities in the movement of market. Meaning, and I'm kind of fumbling some terms here because I'm trying not to talk like you and I like to talk in the middle of the night. But I think that my belief is that things would work a lot better if government would fulfill the role of applying hidden costs of what the market is doing to the market. Meaning, if someone is dumping, this is a very gross, simple example, but if someone's dumping pollution into the river and they don't have to worry about it and they don't have to take on the cost of, damaging an ecosystem or fouling water, they can just do that because it's not a problem. But if the government comes and says, hey, if you do that, you have to pay this amount of money in order to make up for the damage you're causing, then that cost can be taken into account by the person dumping the pollution and thus changes their behavior and makes things work better.
EPA regulations.
EPA regulations, yeah. And more than just regulations so much as an investigation and systemization of what the free market does to the commons.
Right.
Nature. And so, yeah, I find myself, I think that's where I land, that part of what the liberal establishment, as you say, the liberal project should do, that it's being stopped from doing, is meddling in the free market. I'm not a laissez-faire capitalist, but I do believe in the free market's ability to make people happy if we make sure that we are taking into account everything that transactions are doing, both to the people taking part and the people who are not taking part in those transactions.
Okay, that's interesting.
Excuse me.
Because it seems to me there's a kind of contradiction there. The free market puts pollution in the river, so we have to have regulations to prevent that, right?
Yes, although I would go so far as to say, if you can put pollution in a river without having to acknowledge that there's a cost to it, you're going to do it, because that's like that's a freebie. But if you understand that it's not a freebie, then you wouldn't do it.
Okay. Well, here's my issue with this kind of discussion. It's no longer at the heart of political talk. These are, very minor regulatory reforms, technocratic, detail-oriented regulatory shifts focused on quality of water or making sure everybody gets their due and so on. The discussion has blown up and broadened quite a bit. People, I think, in my impression, are no longer satisfied with that kind of gradualistic...
Subtle adjustments
yeah. to what's going on. There needs to be dramatic reform along the lines of FDR.
Do you want to reframe that as a question?
They would probably say they feel that the time calls for reforms that would reflect a kind of emergency of along the lines of the World War II era, Great Depression.
So, what are the emergencies that to you can identify that make you feel that way and make you empathize with people who feel like there are emergencies that exist mm-hmm. that require grand reform?
There are a couple of statistics that really I can't get out of my head, and I'm sure maybe you and probably lots of people have heard them before. One of them is something like 59 or 60% of people make less than $40,000 a year, which, wherever you may live.
This is American citizens or in the world?
In the United States. Yeah. I'm talking, this is all United States.
It's a lot more if you...
Yeah, right. Well, it's a lot more if you take that to a different country. But American, I'm talking about in the United States.
So $40,000 is 60%.
60% of
people. That's a 60th percentile.
Yeah. Okay. Less than $40,000 a year. That's not enough these days. It's really not. We all know that. I mean, the costs of everything are going up. Something like 65% of people can't take care of a $400 emergency. They don't have the money. They'd have to take a loan. They would have to go to a friend to get
A loan. That is a very compelling statistic, that there's like a scarcity of like literal money
right.
for most people.
So it's not just inequality. It's the dramatic extremes of this inequality. There were two really great academics. I can't remember the names right now, of course, but it's actually, I think, a husband and wife. They write a lot and study a lot about deaths of despair, largely white males in the Midwest, dying of alcoholism, drug addiction, and suicide at an increased rate, while all other sort of demographics sort of remain the same. Actually, I read recently there was a spike in African American males in the same way. We're seeing we still have 30 or 40 million people without health insurance. We have 65,000 or so deaths a year because of the privatized health insurance industry. And that's studies. That's not my personal opinion. These are studies that are done by places like Yale and Harvard. So all of this amounts to a crisis for the majority of people that, frankly, Charlie, you and I don't see. We have our families. We live in the city. We're not seeing this stuff. I mean, we can't imagine. There was a piece in the LA Times recently about Skid Row. And Skid Row has always been Skid Row in LA. Lots of people really hard up, drug addicts and things like that. But the extremes, once again, that it's gone to now just seem kind of horrifying. They followed around a fire department for 24 hours in Skid Row. And it was like, what they were going through was just is truly unbelievable.
The fire department, because they also respond to medical emergencies.
They call it the busiest fire department in the United States. They have a big plaque on their wall. So that's the one crisis. That's one crisis.
Inequality.
Inequality is the crisis.
Inequality of income. And it's both a wealth disparity and then also a sort of day-to-day disparity.
I would say it's a real immiseration of a majority of people in the country.
And it looks like Anne Case and Angus Deaton are who you were speaking of. They wrote a book called Deaths of Despair and the Future of Capitalism.
Right.
Well, that's pretty intense.
Really interesting and really sort of, it really stops you in your tracks, the research that they did. The other crisis, of course, just to move along here, is global warming. I don't think that anybody at this point, you know,
so you're
most
using the phrase global warming as opposed to the more politely acceptable climate change.
Yes, because in fact it is warming. It is not just change. It is dramatic warming of the oceans. We haven't seen this kind of, there's all these scientific studies that come out. I don't read every last one of them, but there was a book called The Sixth Extinction. We haven't seen this kind of warming and extinctions since the dinosaurs, you know, 60, 65 million years. We haven't seen this level of carbon in the atmosphere for a million years. We just hit 416 parts per million, I think. This stuff is on people's minds. And yeah. I think the liberal establishment, just to get back to the discussion, has to acknowledge and act dramatically. I think the liberal establishment is being called upon to recognize and acknowledge those crises, and that they refuse to do so at great peril to the majority of people in the country.
How monotonous the sounds of the forest would be if the music came only from the top 10 birds. We give all the birds a chance. WREK, Atlanta.
This is the North Avenue Lounge. My guest is Tyson Duffy, an Atlanta writer, editor, literary critic, and playwright. We are having a discussion of political belief and values against the backdrop of the current presidential primary. WREK Atlanta does not endorse or care about any of the beliefs being posited on this episode of the North Avenue Lounge. So to reframe as we come back in, you and I, while both basically being on one lefty side of the American political scene,
sure,
find ourselves in a lot of ways at odds with tactics, strategy, or even particular candidates. And so this episode is essentially you and I having a public conversation about that difference to try and tease out some details about it. The last thing you said before the ID was global warming.
Sure.
And you threw out some statistics. And I wonder what your take is on the almost inevitable response that some people have to that phrase, global warming, and those statistics, that's a hoax, that it's misrepresented, that it is untrue, and it is a story told for political gain. What is your response to that? We have to acknowledge that that is the way that some people are going to approach that particular crisis.
I think there is an ever-shrinking minority of people who would say that. I think the research is in. I mean, you can't, my response, I guess, part of my response anyway would be, you can't somehow bribe thousands of scientists across the world to all say the same thing. And also, you know, the scientific research is pretty disparate. They come from the mountains and the hills and in Antarctica and the ocean. These are all different people. They speak different languages. And they all are recording different measures of acidification, saltification, whatever, desertification. And it's all pointing to this same sort of overarching idea of global warming or global climate change. There is no way, and this isn't going to convince somebody who thinks it's a hoax, but there is no way to get that number of thinking, working scientists all over the world to align with some kind of major hoax. It's just not possible.
So just, I mean, getting on the record saying that, I think is important to make sure that anybody who feels like they want to dismiss pieces of this argument because global warming is not real can hear where you and I are coming from.
Sure. Okay.
So the crises of liberal democracy, the liberal establishment, inequality, and global warming.
That's where we stand, Charlie.
That drives you into a place of saying we require a dramatic reform. We require a presidential candidate, but also a populace that wants to dramatically reform. Excuse me. I apologize for my throat. What does that reform look like to you? If you think of what the process and end result is, is it all one reform that would capture both of those crises, or is it particular things for each?
Yes, that's a good question, actually. I think they are absolutely interlinked. If we can all admit or accept that we are living in at least a semi-capitalistic society, because, you know, you can debate what capitalism is, but and if that capitalism has driven us to the brink of these crises, we can look at how that one system or set of systems or ideas has linked together these separate crises. How is inequality linked to global climate change? Well, it just so happens that these major oil companies leech wealth and resources off of people whose suffering sort of increases, you know, and you see that all over the world, including in the United States. So there you go. There's just one sort of shining example right there, the fossil fuel industry itself. Not that one has an issue with companies doing what's in their interest to do.
Because I think you're saying the umbrella problem is capitalism. Like if they're burning fossil fuel, literally, is not the problem, but burning fossil fuel in a economy or in a understanding of the world that is capitalistic.
A system like capitalism, it can't exist without liberal establishment, liberal sort of administration of the state. It lives off of it. You know, things happen, you know, there's research done at technical universities, and then that stuff is privatized and turned into an industry. I mean, it's a system that feeds itself, you know. So I'm not really interested in a discussion about capitalism, because I don't actually think that it's as important as people think.
That's interesting.
Or socialism, frankly.
I should butt in here and say I am deeply interested. And okay. I don't want to derail what you and I are talking about, but I do want to like plant my own flag here. I do think that the tenets of capitalism, as opposed to the free market, and the way that capitalism is supported or narrativized, is a huge part of the problems that you just described, inequality and global warming, in the sense that if there is a story of taxes are too high and the government is destroying jobs, if that's the anti-tax, anti-regulation story,
okay,
that's very different from the government is slightly more aggressive in pursuing its protection of the liberal democracy, right? Those are two different stories.
Mm-hmm.
And so the end of the story, taxes are theft and regulations ruin the economy. Mm-hmm. The end of that story is, you know, smash the government with various levels of reduce it or change it. Versus
I see that.
The government has a purpose, which is to tweak the particular costs that capitalism uses to define its actions, that the free market uses to define its actions, and the protection of individual rights in law, rule of law and contract, that kind of thing. So that's why I am deeply concerned with the question of capitalism, even if you are not.
It is. It's not that I'm not concerned with it, but I think it's not exactly at the center of the discussion. What is at the center is that those two different lanes that you just described are now insufficient. The movement towards Keynesian economics, which was standard up through the 70s.
You got to prime the pump, man, if things are slow.
Well, what Keynes really was talking about was using the government in service to the public using economics. So the government can step in as aggregate demand in an economy that is sort of wavering or on the brink of a crisis. This has been sort of erased from history in many ways. People don't talk about it much anymore, and replaced with neoliberalism and deregulation, the precise opposite. What you're seeing now with the populist left movement led by Bernie Sanders is a demand for Keynesian reforms and a recognition that big, broad public programs having to do with global warming, the Green New Deal, having to do with inequality, debt forgiveness, are really the only solution. This is what they say.
Not, yeah, that's their position.
So this is the position of lots of people and the Sanders supporters. That discussion of regulation or deregulate, you know, has become sort of almost overnight. It's been very interesting to watch it happen, kind of marginalized. Because I grew up, you know, we all grew up with Clinton,
deal, yeah.
Clinton, and then Bush, and then Obama. This was all politics was, and that's why it was so boring. Why would young people get involved in politics? It was so, you know, like, why would you go run for government? Why would you vote?
There's no state smashing.
Right, exactly.
There's just tweaking.
But suddenly, somebody shows up with solutions. One of them is Donald Trump. He has his solutions, right? I think you and I agree that's not the direction that we would go.
We would prefer not to have his strategy used to fix problems.
Sure. We don't. There's a kind of anger and finality associated with that we don't identify with, surely. And then on the left, there is the sort of Sanders progressive movement, which is not unique in history. It happened under FDR. It happened under Teddy Roosevelt. Jacob Riis handed him a book of photographs of poor newsies sleeping in little kids in New York, sleeping in tunnels. And it really touched old Teddy. And he initiated a bunch of progressive reforms that gave us almost total literacy across the country.
Yeah.
It's the first time we had that. And public schools as well, and a whole host of other things. These crises come along. Ours is unique, yes, inequality, but also global warming. Global warming is new. And they demand, some would say, political scientists, they tend to require a reformer that goes beyond these sort of typical technocratic debates about regulations and economic points in economics that maybe most people can't quite understand, or they don't know how they would affect their lives. These big, broad programs that Trump also has on the right, he has his version of them, you know, the wall and so on. On the left, you have the left programs, debt forgiveness and the Green New Deal. And these are very major changes that are not new. They go all the way back to ancient Greece, in fact. Solon, the lawmaker in Athens, essentially, he came right after Draco. You know, we talk a lot about draconian laws of the right or whatever, but Draco's claim to fame actually was writing down those laws. He was the first to write down the laws. That's why we remember him. Mm-hmm. They may have been pretty harsh. If you steal a loaf of bread, you get your head cut off or whatever. After him came Solon, and he forgave debts across the board. And that enlivened Athenian democracy 2,500 years ago. You saw that happen under Roosevelt as well. These things happen periodically. We have a choice before us, you know, and this is the choice.
Okay, so I feel like this is a perfect place for you and I to start, like, finding various things to talk about in what we've established here. So this is not a moving on so much as, like, okay, first thing. So I wonder, the Teddy Roosevelt example that you just used, right, which was here are the newsies. They're poor. And he said, well, let's do something so they can all read and lift them up.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't seem so much like a reformer, so much as it seems like a move of liberal democracy, right? Like a tweaking in a way.
Sure.
And debt forgiveness also seems like a tweak as opposed to a reform.
You know? Okay.
And so I wonder what, I'd like to hear what your response is to that.
I think I agree with you. I think a lot of people probably wouldn't see it that way. They would think, you know, you got to pay your way and pay off your debts. You know, you take out a loan for college, you got to pay it off.
Yeah.
They sort of conveniently forget that in the 50s, 60s, and 70s, those kinds of debts just didn't exist. It's really a new thing from the 90s on, you know, that level of indebtedness to school anyway. So there is a kind of sentiment in the center and on the right, and even in the Democratic Party largely, to force those ideas through without even those kinds of reforms. I think
force which ideas through?
You know, individualism, you know, pay it off, get it done. Right. You made the choice. It's your responsibility.
So we're not going to fix this particular problem because to fix it would be to imply that the value that created it is wrong.
Right.
That's the sort of argument that you're seeing.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. That's one thing.
But so just to finish. Yeah. So I think people would see if there was dramatic debt forgiveness for, you know, medical debt is really the biggest issue. I mean, mm-hmm. lots of people go into bankruptcy, and over 60% of people who go into bankruptcy for medical debt actually had health insurance. That's another major issue. I mean, people just can't ignore their own personal pain. You know, they need solutions to these things, and they're not going to be about little taxes and regulations here and there. They probably would say this needs to be fixed so that everybody can have a better life, not just me, you know. But forgiving that debt, you know, that would be something that I don't think we've ever done. I don't know that we've ever forgiven, what is it, $1.6 trillion in debt before. That would be a pretty major reform. If liberals are...
The action would be a reform because of the value that it implied. Is that really where you're coming from?
Yes. Yes, okay. Because it implied that, yes, this system has made a mistake. We, the liberal establishment, have made a mistake, and we're going to fix it. This isn't on you and on your shoulders. You know, we may have told you the story of how you've got to pull yourself up by your bootstraps. It wasn't true, and we're going to make it right. That would be a pretty major admission and a major reform, and this is why there's a lot of resistance to it. Yeah. There's more resistance to... My impression, anyway, is that there's a lot of resistance to debt forgiveness. I think maybe you have a different impression, but to
I think there's a lot of resistance to it. But I think it's also that, you know, there's the debt forgiveness in terms of forgiving medical debt or forgiving college debt seems to be attached fundamentally to creating, you know, free secondary education, like, you know, public free secondary education and public healthcare, you right. know, to create a open to all education system up to what has been recently called undergraduate degrees, and to create a medical system, a health system that does not require immediate payment from patients.
But those, free at the point of use.
Yeah, those are both attached to the forgiveness of these debts. Mm-hmm. So there's the move and then there's the reform. Because if you just did the forgiveness, right, it would be like, okay, everybody start again, but right. the system would exist. And that's almost like, well, you know, I could live through that, I think might be some people's reaction. I can live through that moment in 2020 when the economy took a weird kind of wobble because we destroyed all of this debt wealth. You know, but then the idea of changing how things work, I think, is even scarier. But I think it's incoherent to do one without the other, you know, to change the whole system and not forgive the debt it's created, or to forgive the debt without changing the system.
Of course. Yeah.
So they have to be linked. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Oh, you know what? I'm late on something that I have to do for the radio show. So we'll take a minute. We'll figure out what we're talking about and get back into it. This is the North Avenue Lounge. I need to tell all of our listeners, WREK Atlanta does not endorse or oppose any candidate or political party.
WREK Atlanta presents the DeSoto Hour, an hour of big band jazz, swing, and everything in between. We play all the greats, Saturday night at 7, only at 91.1 FM.
You are listening to the North Avenue Lounge on WREK Atlanta. My guest is Tyson Duffy, a writer, editor, literary critic, and playwright. There's a lot of R's in what you do, Tyson. It's hard to say. Here in Atlanta, Mr. Duffy and I are having a conversation about political beliefs and values on the left side of the American political establishment, trying to tease out some particular differences that we have discovered in our friendship over these questions of what to do and how to do it. And as I've been saying, WREK does not support, disregard, have an opinion about any of the things that we're saying on this show right now. So Tyson, as we come in for a landing on the show, I think that, you know, we've sort of established here's the establishment, but then also the reformers' position, mm-hmm. this sort of more lefty side of the argument is that there are two crises that in a way were created by a neoliberal America, mm-hmm. inequality and global warming, and that they require reformation. So the last couple of things I want to talk about are why, what are the things that we need to avoid through reformation, and why do you think that there is a resistance to fixing those problems?
I don't know that there is. I've seen...
Well, here's why I'm saying there's a resistance. Because there's quite clearly antagonism directed at political figures who promote these solutions.
Sure.
So
sure.
That's why I'm asking, why do you think there's a resistance to the fixes?
I think because any entity, whether it's a company or an individual or an establishment, doesn't want to commit suicide. So that's a perfectly natural thing. So,
yeah, corporations are people, so they probably...
Well, no, I don't mean that. I mean that any entity is a sort of set of interests, and it's not going to be in its interest to invite somebody in who's going to sort of end or reform profitable parts of what it's doing.
So your statement of I don't think there's a resistance comes from, you don't think there's citizen resistance.
It doesn't come from the majority of ordinary people with medical debt, with student debt, with working class people, the vast majority of them. It comes from the establishment itself, the media, different institutions, even people who exist within these institutions. There are progressives, you know, secret progressives running around MSNBC or Fox or whatever, I'm sure. But they are part of a broader system that perpetuates itself.
Yeah.
Right? So to me, that resistance is totally expected. And that's why I think the left movement led by Bernie Sanders is smarter than the right movement, because they see that part of what they're tangling with is people who would wish or claim to identify themselves with those kinds of ideas, but are really ultimately part of a system that's against it. The Trump movement on the right, I think, has just been a sort of chaos machine, and I think he's pretty incompetent in lots of ways. So we've had that for 4 years, and we've seen how it's worked. So on the left, the idea is there's sort of two foes here: the Trump right, and then the establishment itself. But as far as people and voters, the electorate, I think they see through that stuff now more than ever. In fact, there was a time when they wouldn't have seen through it, but they're absolutely seeing through smears and attacks and, you know, dishonest narratives and things like that very easily. In fact, many times when they come up with these things to sort of criticize left progressives of any kind, it ends up working in their favor, and they get like $1 million of donations in a single hour or something. That's new. You know, that hasn't been happening before. So when you see, you know, you see all these things, the crises, these new sort of phenomena taking place, the media sort of panicking at the recent three primaries, you see that there is really a sort of a change afoot, and we have to sort of meet it on its own terms and decide what we're going to do. And that's where I sort of stand, yeah.
Yeah. And why do you think that there is such a pressure from some individuals against progressive or a reformer candidate, even those who are on the opposing side from the current administration.
Right. Because it's in their interests.
You think individual citizens, folks who are, you know, just like living their life, who don't like.
So you mean like a Democratic voter who, you know.
Yeah, I do.
Loved Clinton and Obama, which is, you know, fine. I mean, they're centrist and that's totally understandable and acceptable.
Yeah. Why do you imagine there are still centrists in this moment?
I think because they are probably removed from the material crises that we've been talking about.
The distance from Skid Row, essentially.
Maybe so. Yeah, maybe so. And it's not like I live in Skid Row. I mean, my wife and I do pretty well, actually. You know, we're doing just fine. But I have certainly...
Well, which is it, Tyson? Is it just fine or pretty well?
It's just well. We do okay. You know, I'm not, let's not get into that. But, you know, we're not living on Skid Row. We're not right. close to living on Skid Row.
You are not a person who would but not we be were... able to function without these reforms.
Exactly.
Yeah.
We would be fine. Sure. But the 2008 meltdown, the recession,
yeah.
burned us just like it burned a lot of people. And it turned a lot of heads. And it hurt. And it took a long time to sort of recover from that. Much longer than we thought it would. In fact, the recovery from the recession was one of the longest recoveries in history. It was drawn out for far too long, and so long that Trump gets to claim, which is false, that the 4 years of the good economy that he had was because of his policies. It wasn't. It was because of Obama's recovery policies. But that really hurt, and we saw lots of people really struggle. People that we knew and still know lose their jobs, lose their houses, lose their savings. That really turned our heads. On top of the fact that, as I said, when I was in my late teens and early 20s, I was, you know, reading Chomsky and all these different things and running around the world and trying to figure out my sort of place in the political spectrum. And I was a bit more aware than the average bear. And most people don't have that luxury, you could call it. You know, don't have the luxury of going to and seeing how people on a day-to-day struggle and fight just to get by. I mean, we can't imagine the kinds of things that people go through. People having to choose between medicine and food, or one story I was reading, a guy was having to choose between, he was sick in the hospital and he was having to choose between a $50,000 surgery that he needed and a $50,000 life insurance policy that would go to his wife and kids. You know, this is the absolute endpoint of extreme immiseration. And people see that one way or another. More people are seeing it now more than ever. In fact, historically, when the sons and daughters of the well-to-do, you know, my parents, I come from a, quote, you know, good family from up in New England. My parents did well. They're still doing well. My brothers and sisters do well. When the sons and daughters of those kinds of families start to become involved in this kind of...
When they have the luxury to yes. work in the way the establishment works.
When they are willing to put aside that kind of allegiance to or interest in upper middle class sort of pursuits in favor of the welfare of the ordinary working person. That is an historic thing that happens. And it means that there is a real shift in sort of the winds, the political winds, and the context in which we're living. And it means that things are culminating towards a new, it's going to be sort of a new era that takes place. Whatever it is, we don't know what shape it is, what exactly it's going to look like, but the 2020s are going to represent a new world for American democracy.
Well, I think we've done a really good job then of sort of explicating the difference between, say, a establishment liberal Democrat and a progressive, and why they might make those choices. And I find that maybe we didn't really talk about how you and I disagree so much as we made sure that we had this discussion without the sort of dodges of friendship to allow us to blow off steam. So thank you for being on the show today, Tyson.
Hey, thanks for having me.
I've introduced you as a writer, editor, literary critic, and playwright here in Atlanta, and I want to give you a minute to tell me how you are those things.
Well, I am. I do have a day job where I write for a boutique agency with government on government projects and things like that. But you know, I am also my pursuits center around fiction writing and literary criticism, which you can read online. I publish things at the Millions. And also I write plays. There is a group, the Working Title Playwrights, that I'm associated with. In Atlanta, it's a pretty special group of people and theater artists who work together to develop concepts and plots and ideas for plays for local theater here in Atlanta. And it's a life, you know, it's a life.
So that's WorkingTitlePlaywrights.com. They say they offer stage readings, intensive development labs, master classes, bimonthly critique sessions, and community engagement. And the Millions is themillions.com. And so if I go looking for Duffy, will I find some stuff you wrote?
Sure, sure will. Cleaver Magazine as well.
All right. Tyson, clock on the wall says we got to go.
All right.
Thanks for being on the show, man.
Thanks for having me, Charlie.
You can hear this show and many others at northavenuelounge.com. WREK Atlanta does not endorse, dispute, disagree with, or care about anything Tyson and I have said today. Thank you.